Kane approached the Cobaltville Medical Center on Kappa level. He was dressed in his MAG street clothes, and he felt the eyes of the people in the facility turn to him warily as he walked straight up to the main reception desk past the waiting patients.
Can I help you, Magistrate?
The clerk was a young man, barely out of his teens, with a few spots of acne dotting his rosy cheeks.
I'm here to see a friend of mine, a magistrate by the name of Grant.
I'll just look. He's in room 7D17. That's on the 7th floor.
The clerk handed a scrap of paper to Kane.
I wrote it down for you.
Kane took the paper and glanced at it as he made his way across the buffed floor to the bank of elevators. The note was written so poorly as to be almost illegible. The clerk's hand had been shaking so much. Maybe Kane should come back sometime soon and find out what it was this young punk was so afraid of, what it was he was hiding. Kane tossed the note into the trash can as he stepped into the elevator. Kane's eyes took the whole scene in, and in less than a second, he realized that Grant's body stopped just beneath the torso.
Hey, tough guy. How's it going?
Well, I guess things were pretty nasty yesterday.
Yeah, I guess so.
Looks like you made it out okay. No broken bones?
Not even a scratch. I'm sorry you didn't come out of it quite so well, Grant. Really.
Yeah, well, that's the job.
Kane looked at Grant lying there, and his eyes flicked once more to the place where Grant's legs should be.
You can look. It's okay. I know they're gone.
I wish I could have done something.
You did do something, Kane. That's why I'm here. We're partners, and you did what you had to get me out of there alive.
Yeah, partners.
You're a good guy, Kane, and I appreciate what you did.
But
no buts. Salvo's promised me a job behind a desk somewhere in command, and, well, you know, I've been longing to get off the beat for a while now. It's a good thing. It really is.
What am I going to do without my partner?
There are other partners. Good mags. You'll do okay.
But we were more than a team. We knew each other, knew how to react to situations. We were like one of those mythical beasts, you know, one creature with multiple heads.
Yeah, like, what was it? Cerberus? The dog at the gates of hell? That's us, all right.
The Hound of Hades.
Kane felt the hairs rising on the back of his neck as he remembered his discussion with the psychiatrist the day before. He shook his head, dismissing the coincidence.
You know, this is a good thing. Really. I wasn't kidding about the desk job. There were probably easier ways to get a transfer, but...
And all it took was a terrorist with a molly. Careful what you wish for.
It's done now. It's what I wanted. I kept applying for it, and, well, now I've got it.
Bridget Baptiste worked at her terminal in the hushed historical division of Cobaltville. She sat before her computer in the little cubicle facing the stone wall, her red tresses tied back in a severe bun, wearing a tight blue bodysuit, her rectangular-framed eyeglasses perched on her nose. This day, she was altering the details of a document concerning the clinical trials of a certain medicine. A derivative of the medicine in question was in general use among the lower levels, and it wouldn't do to trigger a panic with such out-of-date information. Bridget leaned toward her mic pickup.
Delete paragraphs 2, 3, 7.
The computer highlighted the paragraphs and eliminated them in a blink.
Insert new paragraph 2 as follows. Test dates as previous. Subjects tested... 150. Period of trial lasted 2 weeks. Halt rewrite.
The operator for the historical division suddenly appeared in a window on Bridget's computer display.
Miss Baptiste, there is a call for you from the educational facility. A Miss Hargreaves, J clearance level confirmed.
Accept.
The teacher's face appeared on the comm screen window of her terminal. Hargreaves was a young woman, younger than Bridget, with dark blonde hair that brushed across her shoulders and a pair of circular, wire-framed spectacles on the bridge of her nose, her own symbol of office.
Miss Hargreaves, how may I be of assistance?
It's your daughter. I'm sorry, I mean your niece.
That's okay. It's a mistake I even find myself making sometimes.
We were rehearsing Abby's part in the play, and she had a slight fall. Nothing major, I assure you. However, she seems quite upset and has become disruptive. So I think it would probably be better if she were to be taken home.
I'll come right over.
Honestly, Ms. Baptiste, it's absolutely nothing to worry about. I think she just needs a little love and attention. Someone to make a fuss over her.
I'll be there as soon as I can.
Grant sat in a wheelchair as Elaine pushed him around the bland corridors of the Kappa Level Medical Hub.
It must be nice to get out of that little room, Grant.
Yeah, it's a party.
Elaine stopped pushing his wheelchair, bringing him to a halt.
Magistrate Grant, we're going to be positive, aren't we?
Grant looked at the nurse, her russet hair shining beneath the strip lights of the corridor.
We'll try.
I believe you are a very brave man, Magistrate. And I would like to ask a favor of you.
Ask away.
I appreciate that it may be difficult at first, even for a very brave man, to manage by himself, after all you've been through. I live alone, but my apartment is large and it's on the first floor, so there's no elevator, no stairs. I wonder if, perhaps, you might come live with me. Is that allowed? For a magistrate, I mean.
Stunned, Grant looked at her. She was a beautiful woman, healthy, and probably 15 years his junior. He saw then what she had meant when she called him a brave man so many times in their conversations.
Elaine, can you do something for me?
What would you like me to do, Grant?
It's hard for me to see you at this angle. I'd like you to stand here, in front of me, just for a moment.
Elaine stepped from behind the chair and walked ahead, her head bowed a little with self-consciousness. Grant watched her walk with her back to him, peering over her shoulder through a curtain of hair, dressed in the pressed white linen garment of her post. She was tall, long of limb, and thin, with just enough flesh on her bones to add womanly curves where she needed them. Elaine turned and stood there, facing Grant in his chair. She blushed as Grant admired her curved hips and the swell of her breasts. He admired her hair, that wonderful reddish brown that reminded him of fall days when it was still warm, when the summer had yet to really make way for winter. The top button of her dress was open, the collar of the uniform spreading like petals, accentuating her long, pale-skinned neck. He admired her smooth, rounded chin, that wonderful elfin smile, a little stub of nose, and her hazel eyes, so full of promise and mischief. She was a dream. Cloudsinger was back in Real World along with Broken Ghost, who had gone to speak with the elders, requesting spiritual support before the final push against the devils of Cerberus. Cloudsinger was left alone in the cave with Decimal River as he monitored the three Cerberus warriors who were held in stasis within the trap.
How are they?
Everything's as expected. They're not getting out anytime soon.
Could they get out?
With enough willpower coupled with a dream slicer or something similar, it's theoretically possible. But it wouldn't happen. Everything they want is there. There's no reason for them to wish to leave.
What about their physical bodies?
The body's just an extension of the mind. A physical manifestation. If the mind tells us it's there, then it's there. Whether we are connected to it or not.
In the world? What of the world?
It's their world. It's where they grew up, with just a few alterations to make it more attractive.
They didn't grow up in the Cerberus facility?
No. I hacked into the personnel files that Cerberus has on them. All three were born in a settlement called Cobaltville, in Colorado, one of 9 utopian cities in their land.
Then why did they leave?
Who knows? They're back home now, with no knowledge of any other life. I've attached a piece of coding to their digital files that we now hold in stasis. A tail code that affects their thinking. Like endorphins pumping into their brains, making them happy.
I don't want them to be happy. They killed Neverwalk. They killed Rock Streaming and Rabbit in the Moon and Good Father and Bad
Enough!
Father.
The pale assassin stood in the doorway to the cave, a frown on her painted face.
Are you a warrior or a child, Cloudsinger?
They killed them, Broken Ghost. We should bathe in their blood for what they did. I don't want them to be happy.
Do you remember what I told you in the dreaming? Our desire was a parasite.
Yes.
Desire and happiness are intertwined. We lose ourselves in our lover's embrace, Cloudsinger. We lose ourselves in happiness. And if we are too happy,
We lose ourselves until we cease to be.
The assassin nodded in silent response. Kane sat at a patio table outside the cafe, his long black coat hanging from the back of the chair, his regulation shades still covering his eyes. Sitting across from him was a beautiful, dark-haired woman with chocolate-colored eyes, explaining the fundamental differences between the current prevailing art schools of Snakefishville, Mandeville, and Cobaltville.
Right now, the Snakefishville school are doing some interesting experimentation with color. Very bold strokes, really expressive, but it's a retread of things we've seen in the history books.
Is that a bad thing?
Like life, art should always move forward, Kane. Haven't I drummed that much into you by now?
I have trouble keeping all the different pieces straight in my head, to be honest.
Yes, your father did a very good job of ensuring you knew all about the laws and the reasons for unification. But he didn't have much time for the other things in life. The note... Well...
What? What is it?
Well, I was about to say the nobler things. But of course, what you do is very noble indeed.
Well, it's a job.
Kane, being a magistrate isn't a job, it's a calling. I couldn't be more proud of you, and I would never expect you to do anything else.
Thank you. That means a lot.
It felt strange to say that, as though he had never said such a thing to his mother before. It felt right somehow, having her there, a part of the puzzle that had been missing all his life.
Did you go away?
Me? Oh, no, Kane, I never went away. Why do you ask?
I don't know.
Kane shook his head as though that might loosen the nagging feeling that was there. When he looked up again, there was a young man, perhaps 15 or 16, running past the cafe tables that lined the promenade. Incredulous, Kane watched as the boy's hand reached out and plucked a patron's bag from the next table to theirs before he ran on.
What are you?
The bag's owner, a chubby, olive-skinned woman in the clothes of a lab tech, stood and pointed toward the young thief as he ran off into the crowd.
That boy! Help! He stole my bag!
Kane was on his feet immediately, automatically grabbing his coat from the back of the chair as he rushed onto the sidewalk.
Duty, Mom. Sorry.
He dashed into the surging crowd after the disappearing thief. Proudly, his mother watched him work. Propped against a stack of pillows, Grant sat up in bed and gazed out of the medical room's window at the familiar buildings of Cobaltville. It was a beautiful place, the result of 100 years of desperation and 100 more of struggle toward a perfect peace. He could conceive of nothing right then that might ever drag him willingly away from this place, this idyllic ville. He glanced down at the stumps of the legs he now had.
Drag would be right.
There was something else, though, something at the back of his mind that kept trying to emerge, like an image seen beneath a flicking overhead lamp. He closed his eyes and focused on whatever was nagging at him. Kane, his partner, was a man whom Grant trusted more than anyone else in Cobaltville, anyone else on the planet. Kane was always in sync with him, always able to cover for him and second-guess his moves. He'd mentioned some sort of mythical beast before he left. The image appeared then, fully formed, a vivid, garish painting of the three-headed dog, its powerful legs and snapping jaws, the reflection of the fires of the underworld in its eyes. It wasn't alive, he knew that. It was something else, a picture, a vid, a dream. Grant opened his eyes.
The Hound of Hades. Cerberus.
Bridget carried Abigail's satchel as she walked her niece to the school gates. She could see that Abigail was fidgeting. She kept pulling at the ragged sleeve of her top and running her finger along a slight wound to her arm.
Leave it alone, Abby.
But it hurts.
I know it hurts, Munchkin, but it will only hurt more if you pick at it.
It's all Luckash's fault.
What? What did you just say?
I said it was all Lauren's fault. She pushed me and I fell off the stage. She did it on purpose.
Bridget stood stock still, her hand reaching out and holding onto the open gate to the school for a moment.
Lauren.
I'm going to punch her in the nose and pull all her hair out.
Don't do that, little darling. It was just an accident.
The sleeve of Abby's top was ruffled and torn, and there was a nasty scab running along her arm with dried blood and blotches on the sleeve itself. However, the fall from the stage hadn't done any permanent damage. It had just shaken Abigail up a bit and left her feeling resentful toward her classmate. Reason enough to remove her for the day, according to Miss Hargreaves. Looking at her furious niece right now, Bridget was inclined to agree. Bridget crouched on her haunches, bringing her head level with Abby's.
Don't be like that, Munchkin. You got to leave early. It's fun skipping school sometimes, and it's even more fun when you're a grown-up.
Auntie Bridget, you don't even go to school.
That's true. I get to skip work instead, which is way, way better.
Bridget smiled as her hand reached up to untie her red hair from its tight bun.
And I get to eat ice cream.
You do?
If we stop and buy some, which means we're going to have to walk. Is that okay, Munchkin?
Abby stuck out her bottom lip as though in deep concentration.
Ice cream monster, say yes.
Bridget stood up, taking Abby's hand as they walked along the sunny promenade toward the market area.
What's an ice cream monster?
I am. I got taken over by an ice cream monster, and now I can only eat ice cream.
Bridget looked at Abby as they wandered along, feeling a sudden shiver run down her spine. Ahead of Kane, the thief was making good progress, his thin, wiry form slipping through the crowd like liquid, instinctively drawn toward the path of least resistance.
Halt! In the name of the law!
The crowd parted around Kane as he rushed on, head down, pumping his arms and legs to increase his pace.
I told you to stop!
The boy leapfrogged a concrete bollard and dashed into the busy market square. Kane hurdled the bollard and rushed into the market as well. The teen thief looked over his shoulder, fear in his eyes as he saw the mag bearing down on him. The woman's bag was still in his hand, and he tipped it upside down, shaking the contents loose. Kane powered ahead, ignoring the strewed contents of the bag in favor of catching the perp. He'd sling this little idiot in a cell, get him off the streets, and let the system bury him. No one ran from a magistrate. The running thief leaped sideways, narrowly avoiding a collision with a woman pushing a baby carriage. Kane followed, vaulting over the carriage and shoving his way along the thoroughfare, keeping pace with the retreating thief running behind the stalls. The thief continued to run, but his pace was slowing now, and Kane knew he had him. The Mag Fitness Regimen demanded exceptional endurance from personnel. Kane could easily outrun one teenage thief. The only things working to the boy's advantage up until now had been his head start and his smaller size. Suddenly the boy stopped, finding himself trapped at the end of an aisle of stalls. Kane waited at the other side of the stall, peering beneath and seeing the thief's feet as he seemed to dance on the spot, looking for another escape route. Suddenly, the boy pushed straight ahead, and the stall before Kane trembled and began to topple. Kane held out his arm, catching the top of the stall and rocking it backward with a powerful shove.
Give up, boy. There's nowhere left to run.
But the thief wasn't done yet. He began running back the way he had come, and Kane followed. In a moment, Kane zipped between two stalls and found himself in the area behind them, the thief's wiry figure 10 paces ahead. The space behind the stalls was a narrow alleyway, with a high brick wall towering to Kane's right, green moss attacking the mortar between the red bricks. Kane ran on, conscious of the boy's sagging shoulders. Adrenaline was keeping the thief moving now, but he was running out of energy. With a spurt of speed, Kane picked up his pace once more and reached forward. With a swift movement, Kane grabbed the boy by the collar of his shirt.
What the fuck? You almost killed me!
You deserve it, too. Never disobey the command of a magistrate.
The boy struggled to a crouching position, then pulled himself up by leaning against the solid wall beside him. Kane stood over him, glaring at the thief through his dark lenses.
You got the bag, didn't you? That's what you wanted, right?
I got the perp. That's what I wanted. Now, let's go.
Kane marched the boy from behind the market stalls, and the crowd of shoppers parted. Something caught Kane's eye as he walked behind the thief. He glanced around, spotting a beautiful girl, perhaps 5 or 6 years old, with honey blonde hair falling halfway down her back. The girl stood at a stall specializing in frozen treats, and for a moment her eyes rested on Kane. The girl's eyes were a vibrant emerald, familiar, and yet he couldn't place it. As Kane walked past with the perp, a tall woman stepped out from the cover of the stall, folding the top over on the brown paper bag she held. The woman was slender, with pale skin and a curvaceous body wrapped in the blue bodysuit of the historical division. Her hair was a vibrant red gold, flowing in a cascade over her shoulders and down her back, falling level with the underside of her breasts. The woman inclined her head to speak to the girl, the afternoon sun catching the rectangular lenses of her spectacles, and her smile seemed warm and honest. Behind her glasses, her eyes were that distinctive, familiar emerald color. Even as he walked past her, Kane knew he had to see this woman again. It was night, and the original tribe was mostly sleeping. Decimal River dozed before the glowing screen of his laptop, a blanket over his legs. Cloud Singer entered the cave silently, her dark skin and blood-red clothing making her just another part of the shadows, only the whites of her eyes giving away her presence. On bare feet, she walked across the cave and stood over the laptop, staring at its screen. The screen had been set to energy-save mode and was much duller than normal, but she could still read the details there. Kane, Grant, and Bridget's minds were trapped. That was the essence of the situation. They were never to free themselves, never to re-enter real world. The digital files were to be held in stasis forever, or until someone pulled the switch, wiping the program. Beside her, Decimal River stirred, rolling his muscles as he woke up.
Cloudsinger.
I need to go inside, into the trap.
Decimal River was still for a moment, trying to make sense of her words as he came to full awareness.
Broken Ghost said not to.
Broken Ghost wasn't there when our friends died, and I was. Neverwalk was 15 and they killed him. It was his first field mission. He didn't even get the chance to fight. They didn't just kill him. They ripped his throat out. His death was slow agony, Decimal River. Broken Ghost didn't see him. I did. And now I want to go inside the trap to make sure, to see for myself that they are truly stuck, that they will be lost forever.
I understand, but I don't think that you should.
Can it be done? Can you put me inside the trap?
I included a backdoor coding into the program. It will allow one of us to enter, to become a character within their new world.
Send me then.
And what do I tell Broken Ghost?
Broken Ghost is asleep. I checked before I came here. She need never know.
Better that she doesn't.
Decimal River rifled through a box of attachments until he brought out a reel of cable with a USB jack at one end and a headset at the other.
What's that?
I cannibalized a mic headset. It will pick up your brainwaves and let you operate inside the trap while your body remains here.
Cloudsinger nodded, taking the headset from Decimal River and placing it over her head as she sat before the laptop.
I see.
Decimal River attached the USB spike to a port in the side of the laptop and began running a series of codes through the mainframe.
Where do you want to go? Which one of them do you want to see?
Cloudsinger thought back, remembering the savage battle in the bunk room beneath the Caucasus Mountains, the skeletons of Russian soldiers all around them as she and Rock Streaming fought with the tall, muscular American with eyes of steel and the build of an alpha male dingo.
Kane. Take me to Kane.
She felt as though she were caught in a sudden downpour, the sort that soaks the dry plains of the outback with much-needed water, the type that's all energy and exhilaration. And then, whatever the barrier was, the change of thinking, the rewiring of the brain, she was through. She was inside another world that seemed every bit as real as the cave in Australia where her body resided. Cloudsinger looked about her, saw the huge tower that dominated the center of the walled man-made settlement. This was Cobaltville, she understood, or a Cobaltville simulation, at least. Figures moved about her, indistinct, unreal, like phantoms, forming from polygons and blocks into human shapes as they walked away from her. Concerned, Cloudsinger looked at her hands, down at her body. She was intact, the blood-red strips of her battle clothes perfectly reproduced in this new world. As Broken Ghost and Decimal River had explained, whatever a prisoner took to the trap would be remade here. Their wants twisted. Cloudsinger was standing in an alleyway between two buildings. She stepped warily out into the street beyond. Directly opposite the alleyway where she had arrived was a towering structure that dominated the entire ville. As she watched, the phantoms around her became people, solid and fully realized, each now an individual with character and distinct mannerisms. Cloudsinger turned to her left and saw two new figures approaching. One was a boy, still going through puberty by the looks of him, about the age that Neverwalk had been when he had been killed. The boy walked with his head bowed, as though afraid. Behind the teenager, a large figure walked purposefully forward, a commanding presence, shoving the boy along whenever he tried to slow down. She recognized the man instantly, despite the dark lenses that he wore to mask his face. Cloudsinger began moving, picking up her pace as she headed directly toward Kane and his charge. She wanted to run, to attack the man, kill him for what he had done in that underground bunker in Russia. She saw his head turn slightly, some intuitive sense realizing that he was being approached, and in that instant she realized her folly. She turned, blending into the crowd, hiding herself from his view. Kane grabbed the perp by the collar and yanked him to a halt just before the wide concrete steps that led up to the administrative monolith. Someone was watching him. He knew it instantly, some sixth sense. His point man instinct kicking into high gear and automatically scanning the faces in the crowd. The people seemed normal, ordinary Cobaltville residents going about their business, no two faces alike. He watched the pedestrians walking past, always busy, always with places to go, living their carefully ordered lives. A rickshaw passed by, pulled by a dark-haired man with an olive complexion, probably of Outlander stock.
What are you doing, man? I thought you were going to turn me in.
Shut up.
Kane clung tight to the youth's collar as he continued to scan the crowd, examining the faces with practiced speed, moving through them like the pages of a flickbook. Across the far side of the street, a figure was retreating, trying to lose itself in the crowd. She was not very tall, her form svelte but muscular. Her skin was dark, and as gaps appeared in the crowd about her, Kane saw that she was covered with tattooed designs, lines and swirls that looked like circuitry. Her clothing was strange, too, strips of cloth of a very dark red, so dark as to be almost black. The woman was facing away from Kane, her head down, but she seemed nervous, her movements anxious. That wasn't so unusual. People got that way around Mag sometimes. And yet there was something odd about the woman, and not just in her clothes or her strange, almost tribal tattoos. Kane couldn't put his finger on it. He filed the information away for later and shoved his prisoner up the steps and toward the main doors of the tower. Turning away, Cloudsinger watched Kane's reflection in the glass windows of the building she walked past. She saw the magistrate enter the administrative monolith with his charge at last. As the doors closed around the two figures, the crowd around her faded, becoming ghost-like blocks, then just strips of code as she watched them. Suddenly, she was in the street alone. The street, too, was an artificial construct, she realized, as the people codes evaporated. The map had to be finalized, however, a complete construction that was available at all times, while the people only appeared as needed. As soon as Kane or one of the others, Grant or Baptiste, appeared, the details of the world would form around them, a radial pattern of activity that surrounded them no matter where they were. The perfect illusion of a living, breathing world, they would never know any difference. She stood there, looking at the tower, wondering what activity was occurring inside to convince Kane that this play world was real. Kane walked across the high-ceilinged lobby of the Hall of Kappa level, watching the slouched shoulders of the perp ahead of him. A tall statue loomed over the wide room, a robed woman holding scales and wearing a blindfold. The statue towered to almost three full stories, bearing down on proceedings within the large open area. Kane walked the perp past it to the main reception desk, recognizing the magistrate on duty there.
One for the cells, O'Brien.
Kane pushed the teenager against the desk. The desk mag glanced contemptuously at the pimple-faced teen before looking up and acknowledging Kane with a warm smile.
Kane! I thought you were off duty today!
I am. This sewer rat happened to bust in on my free time.
What did you do, son?
Nothing.
Bag snatch out on Market Square. Toss him in a cell until I come on shift tomorrow. Run him through the system. Let me know if he's got any priors, okay?
Oh, sure thing, Kane. All right, you scalawag. Turn around while I give you some new jewelry to go with the purchase tool.
The boy turned and let the desk mag cuff him as Kane made his way past the Statue of Justice and through the Kappa level lobby. Cloudsinger stood on the roof of a tall building, looking out over the ville. Birds flew through the air up here, pigeons and white gulls, swooping through the high canyons between the interconnected towers of the residential enclaves. There was a caste system in operation here, Cloudsinger understood, yet another version of utopia built upon the structured limitation and suffering of others. And the system expressed itself through proximity to the sky. The closer one's apartment and workplace to the apex of the towering administrative monolith, the higher one's social standing. Not that any of it mattered, Cloudsinger knew. The whole thing was just an artifice, a construct to imprison the Cerberus warriors. It was a mirror that lied. A cruel trick. She looked out across the ville and spotted a pocket of activity across from her. The boulevard that ran along an apartment block across the south showed people walking up and down. As they got farther from the building's windows, they disappeared, ceasing to exist, their roles all played out. One of the Cerberus people had to be entering that building, or perhaps was already inside, gazing out of the windows at the seemingly normal street scene beyond the glass, utterly unaware of the brief lives that the people he or she saw were living. Cloudsinger turned back and saw people on the street once more, becoming substantial as the main doors to the building opened and a dark-clad figure stepped out. It had to be Kane, of course. Cloudsinger stood at the roof's ledge, peering down, watching the broad-shouldered man make his way along the busy street. He was utterly unaware that the people around him ceased to exist as he turned a corner, with new ones forming wherever he went. She could kill him right now, she realized. She could kill him in this world, his own world. She began to walk along the rooftop, mirroring Kane's movements, several stories above where he walked. He continued moving, heading south, the bubble of activity massing around him all the while, like moths around a lamp. Cloudsinger had reached the end of the roof, and she peered down, watching Kane's retreating figure, surrounded by the buzz of activity. Cloudsinger stood at the very edge of the roof, her bare feet on the ledge, toes curled around it, watching the violent man walk freely through this strange playground. It didn't seem right to her that he had all of this after killing her friends. This was a trap, true, but she wanted him to suffer, to feel the pain that her friends had felt, that Neverwalk had felt. Kane's figure became smaller as Cloudsinger watched. Then the man turned into a cross street and disappeared from view. She stood atop the roof, and her hands clenched into tight fists, remembering Neverwalk with the missing piece of his neck, the bloody pool that his body lay in. Kane reappeared, striding across the gap between buildings, other people passing him. Cloudsinger stepped back from the ledge, looking over her shoulder. Then she backed up, walking backward until she was midway across the roof. She leaned down, coiling her muscles. And she sprang into action, legs racing, arms pumping, running as fast as she could at the far ledge of the rooftop. She leaped from the edge and traveled high in the air between the buildings. She didn't stop, not even for an instant. Ahead, in the gaps between buildings, she saw Kane reappear once more, still making his way south. Cloudsinger ran onward, vaulting a boxy air vent slick with condensation, then veering to her left to follow Kane. Again, the edge of a roof appeared, but Cloudsinger didn't slow, just held her head low to her body. She leaped out into free space. The building facing her was constructed in a series of glass tiers shaped like an Inca pyramid, and she landed on one of the steps and rolled across it, coming to her feet. Cloudsinger looked about her. The building continued up, reaching 10 stories into the air, higher than the structures around it. Looking down at the streets below, she spied Kane once more, easy to spot by simply looking for the crowds. He was just a block away. She could reach him in 20 seconds. The buildings around her were low, 4- and 5-story structures, pristine clean, glimmering in the afternoon sun. 2 window cleaners worked on a mobile scaffold along one side of the buildings. As she looked more carefully, Cloudsinger realized that they weren't cleaning the windows. They were burning off the grime from the brickwork using some kind of acetylene blowtorch. The rulers of Koboldville believed in utter cleanliness, complete, near fanatical order. She ran along the step tier of the building, then, when she reached the end, leaped from it. Cloudsinger gripped the next building's edge, and she pushed herself forward, driving her body over the lip. She ran across the rooftop. The service alleyway was just ahead of her, and she flung herself into the air feet first. With her feet against the wall, she seemed to almost run down it for the first 2 stories, using gravity and momentum to her advantage before kicking off and tracking from one wall to the other. King turned at the last moment, realizing that something untoward was happening in the alleyway beside him. But he was too late. 9 feet above him, Cloudsinger kicked off from the wall and dived through the air at the darkly clad magistrate, raising her other leg into a sweeping kick. King swiftly pushed himself up and looked around. He saw the dark-skinned woman coming up from her crouch, her fierce eyes fixed on his. It was the same woman whom he had spied on the street, the woman with the eerie tattoos and the red-black rags of clothing. Automatically, Kane tensed his wrist tendons, calling the Sin Eater to hand, his finger crooked to begin shooting immediately. Nothing happened.
Damn!
Before him, the girl spun on 1 foot while the other kicked out.
Hey!
He blinked back the disorientation and pain, positioning his left arm before him to block the girl's follow-up kick. The girl was fast, he'd give her that. Fast and powerful, and she clearly had no intention of holding back. She looked so young, probably not even in her 20s, Kane realized. Her hair was braided, thick, clotted twists arrayed all about her head. Her skin was dark, but lighter than Grant's, and she was naked other than the strips of material along her arms, legs, chest, and groin, her bare skin glistening with sweat, her feet bare also. Her body was covered in tattoos, lines etched along her arms and across her chest. The tattoos were strange swirls, mixed with fiercely straight lines, the latter so much like circuitry. Kane realized then that he knew the girl, but he didn't know from where or how. He recognized her as someone he had seen in the past, not in a book or a mag video, but in the flesh, in combat. The girl rushed at him, sweeping her hand along the ground and tossing gravel in his eyes.
Die!
The woman angled her right foot behind his, sweeping it back toward herself. Kane swept her punches away as he struggled to his feet. Upright, his right fist powered forward. She sat down hard, holding her face. Kane took a moment to watch the tattooed warrior, wondering why she seemed so familiar. It was a room, he remembered, with no windows. The room was full of bones, skulls, and ribs, arms and legs, dead people all about them. And she had come at him in a series of blinks as though she weren't really there at all, or as though she moved so fast as to be beyond his comprehension. There had been another one, too, a man in his 20s, tattooed like her and wearing loose clothing. He had attacked Kane in the room of bones with a knife. No, not a knife. It was larger than that. The girl stood and gave him an up-from-under look, her thick braids dropping over her face, her teeth set in a grimace. Kane couldn't place her, couldn't place the fight in the room of bones, but he was sure that it had happened. It felt so real. Then the girl leaped, and her right foot snapped out at his face. He arched his back, pulling himself just clear of the arc of her attacking kick. The tattooed woman landed, her body sinking into itself to absorb the impact. And then, still in motion, she spun and ran off. Incredible as it seemed, Cloudsinger had forgotten how fast Kane could be. The man was as powerful as a stallion, and yet he used that brute strength with subtlety. He was a true warrior, able to weigh and outthink an opponent, learning from every move of their developing conflict. That was how he had trapped and presumably killed Rockstreaming, pinning the man down in the room of bones, preventing her blood brother from dream slicing to escape. He was following her, she knew. She felt his presence behind her, his long-legged, powerful strides eating up the distance between them, relentlessly driving himself after her. Cloudsinger ran, remembering a building with a scaffold on which some men were doing structural repairs and cleaning. Kane was stronger than she was, yes, but she knew something that he didn't. None of this was real. She drove herself onward, heading for the repairmen and their rig over the street. They were at the building just ahead of her, using an acetylene torch on the metal frame of a third-story window frame. Cloudsinger looked about her, her eyes narrowing as she spied the drainpipe running down the side of the building, the trash can affixed at the edge of the sidewalk. She leaped, her speed never slowing, and she kicked against the trash can. From the trash can, her body was already in motion, twisting as she hurtled up into the air toward the building. Then her left hand was swiping at the drainpipe, grasping it, and driving herself upward as she continued to sprint up the wall. Kane could only watch in amazement as the tattooed female warrior climbed up the wall like a cat, her movements seeming to defy gravity in an astounding display of parkour.
What the?
In a few seconds, she was at the cleaning rig, three stories above the street. Atop the scaffold, she kicked out, hitting one of the cleaners full in the face. The girl spun, and her hands grasped the collar of the other man.
No! Please!
She yanked him off his feet, tossing him over her shoulder. Unable to control the torch, the man's clothes caught fire. All around Kane, people stopped and stared, amazed by the bizarre turn of events. The residents of Cobaltville lived in a perfectly ordered society. They had never imagined such a situation was possible outside the Tartarus pits. Kane looked about him, wondering if there was another way up to the cleaning rig. The rig used a pulley system that was attached to the roof of the five-story structure, and its controls were on the rig itself. There was no way to operate it from down here. If Kane was to enter the building, either to work the controls from the roof or to try to ambush the girl at the rig itself, he would have to lose sight of her, and in that time, she could seize the opportunity to escape, to disappear once more into the crowd.
Damned if you do and damned if you don't.
And then he saw the woman warrior take the acetylene torch in one hand, and holding her free arm extended, she set the torch on her arm, playing its thin blue flame up and down her skin until it caught fire. The flesh popped and burned beneath the fierce power of the torch, and all the while the girl simply gritted her teeth, watching the flames dance higher and higher along her arm. Cloudsinger tossed aside the torch and placed her hands together, almost like praying, bringing her elbows forward until they touched. The flames flicked from her left arm to her right, dancing to and fro in the breeze as she watched. The sensation was unearthly, a pain of such intensity that it threatened to overwhelm her. She stood on the swaying rig above the street and spread her burning arms out to her sides, hands outstretched, palms facing the skies above. A flock of white gulls flew by her, and Cloud Singer reached out and snatched one from the air. Holding its body in her burning hand, its pure white feathers caught light in a second, turning gray as an oily smoke poured from its body. Whatever the pain is, she reminded herself, none of it is real. It's all just a part of the illusion, the trap, the mirror that lies. With that confirmation running through her mind, she tossed aside the burning carcass of the gull and leaped into the air, plummeting toward the ground where Kane waited, watching her. Kane braced himself as the warrior woman came at him through the air, her arms bright as the fires played along her flesh. She had to be high on something, whacked out on some illegal hallucinogen that was being produced in the Tartarus pits or imported from the Outlands. No one would voluntarily set fire to themselves during battle. The girl crouched on the sidewalk, watching him with fierce eyes, the flames licking up and down her arms.
I don't know what your problem is, but you need to turn yourself in right now with them to help you.
The tattooed woman leaped up, swinging her burning fists. Kane took a step back, wishing he had his Sin Eater. Kane saw an opening and he kicked out. She spun, recovering instantly. The woman looked at him, her eyes narrowed in contempt as the flames reached her shoulders and began to play across her chest and torso.
Die!
Kane felt the heat of the flames on his bare skin as the crowd around them kept their wary distance. The girl was a whirlwind of movement, moving faster and faster. It hadn't been a sword, Kane remembered suddenly, thinking back to the battle in the Room of Bones. It had been a boomerang made of steel or titanium. The girl kicked at his solar plexus, then followed up with a right cross. Kane lashed out blindly, sensing rather than seeing where the tattooed girl was. He opened his eyes in time to see the girl's burning hands reaching for her chest. Kane lunged forward, his foot outstretched, ready to pin her to the ground where the flames could do the least damage to him. His foot raced toward her chest, but the girl was gone. She had disappeared. Open-mouthed, Kane looked at the paving slabs beneath his foot, then up and down the street. The cleaning crew was back at work on the building, seemingly as though nothing had happened. The pedestrians and gawkers who had been watching the battle just moments before were all wandering off, heads down, going about their business as though nothing were out of the ordinary. Kane grabbed a passerby, pulling the bewildered man by his shirt and pointing at the ground where his foot rested.
You saw her, right?
Who?
A woman, about 5'5", body covered in tattoos, arms on fire.
The man looked at Kane as though he were insane, and Kane shook him angrily.
Do I need to remind you that lying to a magistrate, even an off-duty one, is an offense?
I didn't see anything. I'd never lie to a mag. Really, I wouldn't. Please, let me go. I didn't do anything wrong.
Annoyed, Kane let the man go. He stepped back, pacing to the spot where the woman had lain. There was no evidence of her, no scorch marks or charring where the flames would have burned, nothing. People walked to and fro along the sidewalk, ignoring the confused mag standing there, eyeing the scene. It was odd, like something that hadn't really been happening at all, Kane realized. Like a training simulation after you pressed reset.
What the hell is going on here?
The first thing that Cloud Singer became aware of was Decimal River, staring into her eyes.
She's coming out of it now.
Cloud Singer reached up, momentarily surprised to find that her hands were no longer on fire, and touched at her skull.
What? What did I tell you? What did I say about Desire, Cloud Singer?
That it is a parasite. That it ensnares the individual.
So why did you go into the trap, Cloud Singer? Tell me that.
Because I wanted to see how the trap worked. I wanted to ensure that it was working as you had promised.
You wanted?
Well, what if there had been a flaw? What if you hadn't realized it until it was too late?
Desire is a parasite that traps the individual. You went inside the trap because you wanted to, Cloud Singer. No other reason than that. And so your desire almost trapped you there, too.
Desire is a parasite within me, too.
Broken Ghost nodded.
Very good, Cloud Singer. You've learned a lesson.
Cloud Singer stared at Decimal River's laptop screen.
I took the data held by the Mattrans and added a transgenic alternator to their DNA sequences.
Cloud Singer looked at him blankly.
Essentially, I made them a Bayas. Doubles of the Cerberus warriors that follow our commands.
What are they doing now?
Decimal River enlarged a window on his glowing screen, upon which data flows raced by.
The three of them are active, pursuing their primary objective.
In the shadows of the machine room amid the various units, Kane was using a heavy wrench to loosen bolts on the main air conditioning processor. The two bucket-like canisters of phosgene were resting on the floor close to his feet, and both of them were still sealed tightly. The next bolt wouldn't budge. It may well have been stuck in the same position for 200 years.
Damn it!
He took a step back and stared angrily at the processing unit, hands on hips.
Well, there's more than one way to crack a nut.
Kane took up the wrench once more and ran his free hand across the front panel of the processor. It was thick with a black powdery dust, though whether this was an accumulation of weeks or months or years, he couldn't tell. Kane pushed against it. It wouldn't buckle to his touch, but it was thin enough that he might bust through it with a few good swipes of the heavy wrench. He took a half step back, holding the wrench in a two-handed grip and raising it behind his shoulder like a baseball player in the batter's box. Pulling the wrench back, he saw a jagged, silvery scar had appeared in the black dust where the wrench had hit. The metal panel had dented just a little, a tiny silver kiss against its flat surface. Kane pulled the wrench over his shoulder again, determined to get through. Eventually, a large rent ran across its surface, and a corner was torn from its housing.
There we go.
He smiled, looking at the hole. He then pulled at the rent with his hands, enlarging the separation. Kane eyed the bucket-like canisters on the floor beside him. He wanted to open both canisters of phosgene while they were inside the unit, both to ensure that they did the maximum damage and also to hide the evidence of his sabotage from a casual viewing. He yanked at the panel, but it wouldn't bend far enough, and he realized he needed a lever to properly open it. Picking up the wrench once more, Kane got to work. As he worked, Kane was unaware that a man called Ben Michaels had entered the vast processing room and was watching him, his brows raised in a mixture of surprise and confusion. Michaels, like so many of the staff at Cerberus, was a Menetius Moonbase exile. In his late 40s, with tanned skin and a balding pate, Michaels was an engineer. He had adopted the role of maintenance man for the redoubt, along with a number of other people best suited to the task.
Hey, hey! I don't think you should be doing that!
What's it to you?
Wait! I know you. Kane, isn't it?
Yeah, Kane.
I don't know what's going on, Kane, but this wasn't okayed by me. That's no way to handle a wrench, friend. I don't want to rain on your parade or whatever, but whatever your orders were, no one told me you'd be doing this. That is to say, I mean, whatever it is you're doing.
Kane glared at the engineer from the darkness, feeling the heavy weight of the wrench in his hand.
I'm sure we can straighten it out. Here, let me show you my orders.
Kane pulled the wrench back and swung again. Blood was smeared across Michaels' face. His nose had caved in, and his left eye was turning red as he tried to keep his balance.
Oh, what the devil are you doing?
Showing you how to handle a fucking wrench.
Skylar Hitch flung down her miniature screwdriver in annoyance.
Damn it!
Donald Bry looked up at her from his monitoring post beside Lakesh on the other side of the Cerberus Operations Center.
Something wrong, Skylar?
Just... I can't get this stupid capacitor to... Ugh!
The normally timid computer tech looked as though she was going to punch the desk in front of her, where the circuit boards that she was working on resided. Next to Donald Bry, Lakesh checked his desktop cron.
It's almost 9 p.m., and I rather suspect you were working at this problem before I came in this morning, Skylar. Why don't you go to your quarters and get some sleep? Our old, worn-out computers will still be there in the morning.
Thank you, Dr. Singh.
Skylar ran a hand through her hair, pushing at her dark bangs, where strands had escaped the ponytail she wore. She reached for the screwdriver and placed it carefully beside the motherboard at a perfect 90-degree angle to the edge of the desk.
I'm sorry.
Think nothing of it. See you tomorrow, Skylar.
Lakesh turned back to the report that he had been assessing with Donald Bry before pausing, a thoughtful, faraway look in his eye.
Should we get back to this report, Lakesh?
You know, it is getting late for all of us. Why don't we conclude this tomorrow, everyone? With fresher heads and sharper eyes.
With that, the bulk of the monitoring team stood from their desks and made their way toward the doors. With no one out in the field, the Cerberus Operations Center could function with a skeleton staff quite easily. Most of the monitoring systems functioned automatically and rarely needed input from a human being. The remaining crew were Brewster Filboid, who stayed at the communications desk to monitor any incoming calls, and Trent, the sallow-faced operator whose primary responsibility this day was for the METrans, but who would double as general systems checker and button pusher until the next shift came on at 1 o'clock a.m. Bridget Baptiste remained behind, too.
Dearest Bridget, you were out in the field this morning, and you're still working on your reports?
It's a field report. I like to get these finalized while all the information is still fresh in my mind.
Bridget's notorious eidetic memory made her statement a fallacy, he knew, but he didn't bother to argue. Some things you just wanted to get out of the way rather than putting them off for another day. He had known Bridget a long time, since way back when he had been her section supervisor in the historical division at Cobaltville, and he had always admired her dedication to a given task, her utter attention to detail.
Make sure you get a proper night's sleep, though, Bridget.
Oh, don't worry. When I'm finished here, I'll sleep like a baby.
In the hidden cave in the outback, Cloud Singer turned to Broken Ghost, a frown creasing her brow.
So they're clones?
Not really. Their technology, the METrans, works by generating and replicating digital files, downloading and uploading the matter that makes up human beings, their belongings, their essence. Like a computer, it's essentially the transfer of a file containing information. Nothing more than that.
The files are held by the METrans units, but they are instantly wiped when the person rematerializes from quantum space. If they weren't, it would be the risk of 2, 3, or 100 of the same person running about. It's a basic failsafe. I broke the failsafe, adding a strip of code to the transferring files. A virus worm that makes the reborn Cain, Grant, and Baptiste pursue our needs over their own.
Is that possible?
There are limitations. Their memories are flawed, so they will paint in the details of their past as required, like characters in a story.
With more time, without the pressure of the Death Cry wave front, we would have made them perfect.
Cloudsinger nodded, finally understanding the full scope of Broken Ghost's audacious plan.
You promised me the head of Cerberus. That was our agreement.
His greatest warriors are in prison beyond reach, and Cerberus itself will fall next. Then I'll move in and kill Lakesh, completing our contract.
Cloudsinger bowed her head in acknowledgement, cursing her own impatience. Once Cain had the front section fully open, he crouched beside it and took a cloth from his pocket, tying it over his nose and mouth. Then he placed the first canister of phosgene inside the main junction of the processing unit, where three large pipes met, and pulled at the seals. He then placed the second canister across from the first, wedging it where two wide pipes met, cooled by rushing water before they fed the Cerberus base with fresh air. Once he was finished, Cain put hand and shoulder to the misshapen front panel and shoved until it bent back in an approximation of its former setting. The repair wouldn't stand up to scrutiny, but in the darkness of the room it would suffice. It only needed to remain undetected for 12 hours. By then, the lethal toxins would be in every air shaft, feeding the Cerberus personnel with the deadly phosgene gas. Cain tossed the bloodstained wrench beneath the piping. He stood back, admiring his handiwork, and beneath the kerchief he had placed over his mouth, he smiled, a broad and terrifying grin.